When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Baltimore Psychiatric Facility, a Too Much movie. We're going to go down a hallway. Do not go near the glass. Do not hand over any pens, any paper clips, any staples, because I've got brooding prisoner psychopath Chris Candy and the Migs of our podcast, Rob Belushi. I am, of course, Blake Howard. Hannibal Lecter standing up the back, just awkwardly standing in the middle of a room, waiting for someone, begging someone to say, please do a podcast about a 1990s movie that is way too much. Chris, Rob, we finally, it was staring us right in the face. We deliberate and argue and go back and forth so much about movies from the 90s that like are too much. And Rob had like a lightning bolt moment. He's like, guys, it's been staring us in the face this whole time. Blake's about to do the Mindhunter series. He's talking about Man's Manhunter. Why haven't we done Jonathan Demme's The Silence of the Lambs? Holy.
It was the 12th body found, but the first victim.
Yes.
Because we covet what we see every day.
Yeah.
We knew the movie, you know?
Yeah, it was a Hannibal Lecter kind of riddle that we had to solve that was always right in front of us. The victim was staring us right in the face
every
it
time
was this movie.
It was like Donald Trump said Hannibal Lecter is real. And then I was like, we have got to look at this movie.
Yeah.
You guys would also be familiar with a comedian named Chris Fleming. Who has made an impression of Hannibal Lecter so fun over the last couple of years online. But I just have to start by just saying, like, maybe one of the most important movies of the 90s. It's only the third movie ever to get the big five at the Academy Awards: Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Screenplay. It's only the third movie to ever do that. 16 minutes of screen time total. Anthony Hopkins as Dr. Hannibal Lecter. We're going to dig into that. Jodie Foster just come off True Detective, Night Country, which Issa Lopez, who's the showrunner and writer and director of many of those episodes, talked about like wanting to cast her out of this movie. It's obviously Ted Talley, who's a now Academy Award-winning screenwriter, who's adapted the great Thomas Harris novel, The Silence of the Lambs. It's like a thing that so many TV shows have tried to capture its magic, whether it's Hannibal, whether it's that Clarice show. It's tried to recapture its own magic in things like The Ghastly Red Dragon, directed by Brett Ratner, or actually the quite delightful Hannibal by Ridley Scott, which is just absolutely insane. Ridley in God mode, as far as I'm concerned. But this movie is so special on every conceivable level. I actually don't even know where to start. Rob, start. Help us start this thing.
Well, look.
Yeah, get it going.
Can I start with like a personal anecdote about this movie? I mean, first of all, the Academy, I looked at like the years before and after, and like this is the one time where the Academy Award was given to my favorite movie of the, like where I felt like inexplicably got it right. And
yes.
So strange, right? Because it's a psychological, it's so much more than a psychological thriller. It's like a wonderful treatise on gaze and the psychopathology of the system we're in, encased in a thriller. But for me, this movie is seminal because I was in fifth grade and I read Silence of the Lambs. My buddy Jake Berlin, who I think is a playwright now, and I went on like a Thomas Harris kick in fifth grade, and we read Silence of the Lambs. It was incredibly impactful, obviously the scares, but also just as a book. And then like 2 months later, the movie came out. And to this day, Jake and I, we sat and we wrote a fan letter to Thomas Harris back when you had to like dig it up from the pub and send it in. And we sent it in. He didn't return the letter, but then the movie came out, and I mean, I'm 11, you know, turning 12 or 12 turning 13. And this movie rocked me then, but rewatching it now, it's like one of those movies where, and this is why I love this podcast, guys, because it gives me an excuse to go back to movies that I've seen and loved and see it as like a new text. And it always justifies the time and the watch. I mean, it's a vibe. It's unlike anything I've seen before or after. The it deserved of all those awards. And you know what I think people watching the movie now or who are a little bit younger fail to comprehend is it was those 60 minutes of Anthony Hopkins is it sears into the consciousness that it was so easily parodied through sketch and animation and all these things. It became a tentpole of just like a lexicon, you know, even the fava beans and all that stuff, which like, but when you saw it as a young person or as a first time viewer in a movie theater, it was fucking scary, man. And like, I think that's why everyone flipped it into like, oh, you know, whatever. And that Ridley Scott movie is such a wonderful return to the character because you see so much more. And like, the one thing I was thinking this time is like, Clarice, why didn't you just go to the Duomo? Like, he had the fucking picture in his cell. Like, that's where he was going to go if he disappeared.
So he's going.
You know, you're so close to the way you're going to catch him. You know what I mean? But anyway, this movie was an early imprint on me. And because Thomas Harris didn't write me back, I spent 5 years on Twitter being absolutely psychotic to every author that I could get my hands on. Don Winslow, you are my father.
Chris.
Yeah, Rob, you, when I was like starting to watch this movie, I was just going like, this is such a Rob Belushi film again. Like, here we are, we have arrived. but I mean that in the bluntness of the film. It's like, you know, I think we are in a new era of movies that have different vibes, have different tones to them. This is just like super aggressive, super raw. And I don't know if it's like a major hot take, but I think to your point, maybe this was like the first time. It's a very surgical movie, even in the watch, in the edits to it. It feels very like moment to moment in these very well architected scenes. They all look really beautiful. Like that opening shot of just kind of going into the cell in the psych ward is just like, it has such a feel to it. But I think that this might have been the first time where it was like, we're going to do it, but we're doing it so fucking well. And it's just like loaded and stacked with incredible actors, incredible performances. You know, the reason that these things don't do as well down the road is because they just don't have the same pedigree of performers filling these characters. You don't have Jodie Foster, you don't have Anthony Hopkins, you don't have an amazing cast of supporting characters. You know, Ted Levine as your kind of like psychopath, like it's just, it's got all of the beats to it. And I think it feels so much like every movie we've done, but it's just, it's exactly that like seething villain just staring at you, telling you exactly what you are looking for, right? And it's exactly that. And so I just totally enjoyed it. And again, yeah, it is such a standalone film. And I think a lot of the movies that we do on this podcast, there are carbon copies that come later. I think that that's also becoming kind of a narrative of our picks and our selects. And this is very much the psychological thriller. It kind of feels like Fugitive at some points, but it feels like a horror film at other points. You're terrified while you're watching it. And then it's also what a lot of those movies aren't able to do is scratch this gratifying surface of connecting the dots. You know, a lot of movies, when they connect all the dots, you're like, all right, that was cool. This one's like, holy shit. And I think you don't get like Usual Suspects if you don't have this movie. I don't think you get a lot of movies unless this wasn't in the zeitgeist, wasn't in the collective subconscious, if I will. Really enjoyed this one.
Hey, I mean, I don't mean to step on you here, Blake, but like there's two things that you said, Chris, that I really love, which is, you know, first of all, this movie's been covered. Of course, we're not going to have any hot takes. It's going to be personal impact and just raising up what a fucking masterpiece it is. But you're right. It is so blunt. And Hannibal yeah. Lecter says that to Clarice. You're very frank, Clarice. I'd love, you know, I think it'd be interesting to know you. I forget, like in real life or in right. another experience. And I love the bluntness of the film. Are the close-ups, how those scenes play out so close to the people. You know, he does not let you look away or be impacted on the humanity of not just Crawford's like sterile reaction to Frederica Bimmel, but Clarice's, you know, just hanging on through that autopsy, or the way Lecter is affecting her, or, you know, the way when she's fucking hit on or subjected to the male gaze of Frederick Chilton.
You know what
I mean?
Like, oh my God.
Yeah. Oh my God. The definition of male gaze. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you see it.
Preening peacock fuck, it. I just kept saying in my head, you preening peacock fuck.
That fucking jacket, that the green jacket, and red jacket.
The jacket is so, it's, he's a drift lord from way back. The pens, the fucking.
He's a fucking drift lord. Yeah, dude.
I just want to say one thing, because you touched on something, which is, I love the series Hannibal. I'm about to cover.
Loved it.
Love the series. Hannibal.
Loved it. I never saw it.
Oh, Chris. Oh, you have got a Amazon. Gift. Yeah.
This is a world I have not dove into. This is the only one I've seen in the season.
Okay. Well, like just say next you have to watch Manhunter, yeah, because Rob and I have a different psychotic relationship with that. So you have to watch Manhunter. But Hannibal is the production design makes it like this kind of nightmarish dreamscape. And I think that Michael Mann's formal quality, it's like him in absolute, and we'll dive into this in the series, and I know Rob's going to come on and have a chat about it too, but it's like him in absolute formal God mode with adapting that. The thing that gets me every time about watching Silence is, there's a cinematographer, Tak Fujimoto, Japanese cinematographer.
And when his name comes up in the credits, the dude is cocking the gun in the training room.
Yeah,
and
sure
it's
is.
Like some fucking air. It's so great.
That's a very gangster little, like, people like to put like where the director's name shows up in the credits, like, you know, of all the movies, but like I think cinematographers might be a fun game to play, like get some screenshots where the cinematographer's name pops up. But Taika Fujimoto and Jonathan Demme make this movie like it is the reality and the dreams and visions and nightmares are all imperceptibly the same. Like what gets me is like Clarice, they're just about, you know, Frederica Bimmel's body, they're going to her body, they're looking at it, and she just has a vision about being at her father's funeral, and you see her stagger into her own vision, and there's no like weird haze that comes over, no black and white, no sepia tones. Not, you just are in the vision of what is in her mind in that moment. And it's imperceptible between the stark reality of what you're seeing and Bill's gaze and all those things. Everything is so tactile. Everything is so like, the color of the world is like soaked out in a way, but it's so just like, I can't describe it other than it's like, if you ever like laying down face down on like concrete and you can see the sort of like drained, like sun baked nothing of the contours of it, that's this movie. It just feels like there's some look in it that is so affecting that every time I watch it, I'm just like, as soon as it's on, I'm like, you can see how many movies chase this. They chased it. They tried so hard to ape its style. And it just, the way that Demme uses close-ups, the way that he uses spaces, the way that the textures are captured, you can't make magic twice. You can't make magic like this. It was so special.
Yeah, I agree. I think to that point, like, a lot, I feel like, this is the most one of those movies that has a very strong cinematic language from the visual. Yes. You know, like a lot of our movies that we watch are beautiful on this show, but this one has got a language that's going on that's intentional. And it's to that point. It reminds me, as you were talking, I just watched the movie Paris, Texas for the first time.
Oh,
I'd never seen that. And
I just watched the first time.
And I was watching it. Yeah, and I'm watching it going like, God, this movie has influenced so many other movies, and I've seen the other ones first.
Yes.
And everyone's, and I feel like when I was watching this, I was going like, this is kind of the same thing, but for the psychological thriller, you know, and it, yeah, like you said, what did you, Rubicon, it's created a lexicon of like, even like just, he, you know, dude, Hannibal Lecter is like Bart Simpson. It's like he's a huge fucking character in the world. You know, it's like this is a big deal character that I didn't realize was only in the movie for 16 minutes.
But
like, well, holy.
Yes, Chris, like the cinematic language is – to me, Jodie Foster, this – for me, this is – I mean, it beats – every performance almost out there. It's incredible. Right. And he said she is alone at the beginning, only punctuated by, you know, a man giving her a direction and then watching her as she leaves. And she's alone in the end, you know, essentially with the escalation of what being watched all the time is a man making a suit of women. You know, of how she is the smallest in a room full of men everywhere she goes, everywhere, every time men pass her, she is watched, she is victim as much as Captain Martin in this, because the world's eyes are covering her every single day. But to Blake, a couple points that Blake's making, like, very interesting watching Manhunter and then Silence of the Lambs in the same week for me.
Yeah.
Because they are linked. Even through cast, right? Blake, like,
there's a couple. Bonnie.
Lieutenant Boyle is in Manhunter. He drops him off at the house in Atlanta. Yeah. And then the bug guy, I forget his name, but he's in it too.
Yeah.
Isn't he? Yeah, he plays like the fingerprint guy, but like Anyway, he's in Manhunter too. So you can see Demi like calling back to this piece of work that he is very consciously making giant changes with formally, which is like leave away all the neon, all of the, you know, the penetrating color of Manhunter and bring it into like what I can only describe as like undulating blandness and beige, right? Yeah. There's so much, and there's so much texture to it. To your point, like so much brick, so many leaking, you know, rivulets yeah. of water. So, and always the closer you get into the interior, the darker the interior is. But when he comes out and he yeah. shoots exteriors, they're so fucking boring. And it's such a great testament to like what we're looking at, even in Hannibal Lecter, like on the outside, he is all of the results you would try to compile for your life, successful, courteous, brilliant. But when you look inside, like she says, can you turn around and use that high powered perception to look at yourself? It is a disgusting, savage, vicious world that is all, you know, protected from our gaze by these simple, bland, and very like invisible structures that we put on, like the exterior in Calumet City, like the exterior of Mrs. Lippman's / James Gum's house, you know, the same way that Hector Elizondo, the same way Lecter uses courtesy as like the binding factor of all connection. And that's so brilliant. Her first words to him are, I'd like to talk, you know, may I speak to you? She asks his permission and the bond is made.
Yeah.
Those dreamscapes you're talking about also speak to like, I love that moment where you've seen her creeping up on her dad in the beautiful flashback, you know, catch any bad guys today, daddy, no, Angel, they all got away, when she's sneaking up on her dad. And then it cuts to Jodie Foster sneaking, like starting to move in that same way that the little girl does towards the casket, and then she becomes the little girl. It's beautiful performance. The flashback is so heartbreaking to see how she began, that yeah. she is this girl that is a victim of this fucking world that is ready to manipulate, exploit, and or rape and destroy her, essentially. And then becomes that girl again in that funeral home. That the linkage is there because we carry it all in every moment. And that's what the story of James Gum is, right? He was created. And it's the same as Francis Dolarhyde, you know, it's yeah. that same story. This person was created through degradation and torture and abuse. The same with James Gum. And so be careful of that exterior, because the well that is hidden in that house is terrifying. Yeah. So when you look,
yeah.
look in that close-up that is so uncomfortably close for normal people who want to look in a medium. You know, yeah. everyone wants to stay in a medium shot. It is safe. It is comfortable. We can perform these the dance of courtesy and then leave. But you must look more closely. And I just, it's one of the best movies that's ever been made. And
by far.
You can watch it 1,000 times and get something new.
Yeah.
Just him standing there. Like,
oh, it's
Rob,
terrifying.
Got young kids. You know sometimes how you walk into a room and they're just standing in the room and you're like, hey, Lecter, what the fuck are you doing? Like, you just want to say, like, what are you doing? Don't scare dad anymore. Dad doesn't need this. My heart's too fragile. But like him just, she comes around the corner. There's like, as you said, there's like the brooding psychopath and there's Miggs who's like climbing the walls. And then you walk to Lecter, and in the middle of this cell, there's a thousand things that he could be doing. He could be laying in the bed. He could be sitting down. He could be sketching. He could be reading, as we see him later on in the movie. But his first introduction, he's standing almost like perfectly upright as like the center point of that room. And he's just like,
oh, erect.
Yeah. Good morning.
Erect.
Good morning. And you're like, what the fuck is this guy? Like, he's not
bathed in light. Yeah. Bathed. Yeah. Absolutely bathed in light. The frame is in the whole movie. Yeah. And Chris, you're right. Those sweeping handheld or steady cam, I'm not sure which it is, of going into Lecter, the first, it's the same as our first introduction into Ted Levine, who, you know, Ted Levine, Jame Gunn, so that Wayne Grow could Wayne Grow. I mean, that fucking guy didn't work for years after that.
Michael Mann even asked him, he's like, oh, do you want to do Wayne Grow for Heat to Ted Levine? He's like, I can't, Mike, I can't play another one of these guys. Just make me one of the cops, please. And he's like, all right, Ted.
Yeah, is that how it works?
Bang, 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 bang.
Bang, bang. Dude, oh. Bang, bang, bang.
Bang, 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 bang. Yes. It's so funny. In this movie I worked on, in Canada, I was playing a criminologist, and I totally stole that from his character, because there's a point where I'm talking about gunshots and I just went right to Heat. I was like, two gunshots here, bang, bang. Yeah, oh, sorry. Oh, wait. So he was up to play Wayne Grow too? Is that what it was?
They knew each other, because Ted Levine has popped up in quite a few Michael Mann movies, particularly he comes back to play sort of creepy. I don't know if it's like he doesn't really play like an identifiable individual, but he plays like this creepy like amalgam of like the FBI forces that hunted down Ali. So especially in some of the more extended cuts you see of Ali, he's like the creepy thing. So I think they knew each other, and he was a big admirer of his work. And you know, it's just that dialogue, as you said, Rob, before about Demi and Mann kind of talking to each other, casting the same guys because they were fans of these same great actors. And he's like, hey, like, I've got this role. Like, is this something you want to do? Like, I think if you're casting a movie with like a psychopath in it after Lambs and you don't talk to Ted Levine, you're kind of stupid, because it's like, it's much in the same way that like they're trying to capture something like the glean and the positivity of this movie. And he's like, no, Michael, I can't play another guy. Like, I can't, like, it's my fucking life's over. Like, give me something to do. He's like, yeah, cool, you're one of the cops. Bosco,
what a great fucking character actor.
Bosco. Hey Rory.
Yeah, he's such
hey
a
Rory guy. He's
it's just funny, because as I was watching that reveal scene, it's like he's got such a Wayne Grove feel to him, like with the hair and the, I was like, oh man. So yeah, so good.
Well, and the way, like, when he's clocking Catherine Martin doing his like Ted Bundy thing with the couch, and he's kind of in shadow, but you can see him look over to her three times with that couch to check her vibe. And it's so fucking sketch, dude. Like when he's like, yeah, get in the van. I want to push all the way back in there. The moment before he climbs in the van, and where she's in the front,
dude, we've all moved house before, right? Or moved furniture in your own house with your partner. And there's something that, like, I know this sounds so dumb, but it's so profound to me in the movie, which is like, say I'm moving a piece of furniture. You, as the guy or the person who is stronger, always takes the more difficult route. Like, you take the walking backwards, right? Or if you're carrying something upstairs, you go the bottom. So you're carrying most of the weight as it's going upstairs, if someone who is not as strong as you is helping. And the fact that he picks it up and turns her into the car, I'm like, the strong person should be on the back of that, pulling it into the car, right? Because it's harder, because you have to crouch. And just that little tiny, like, very relatable thing really fucks you up for, like, weeks after you watch this, because you're like, that subtle maneuver is just, that's the snare. Like, and she is completely such a sweetie pie, Catherine Martin, Brooke Smith, who's amazing, that she's just like, Oh yeah, okay. Like she's just like, oh, okay.
Well, her lizard brain must be like on fire once she hits that wall, you know. Oh. It's so scary.
You about a size 14?
Oh my god, bro, dude.
There's so, like, honestly, shout out to Maria Lewis, my dearest friend, who like we have quoted this movie to each other, like I've said the most disturbing lines from this movie so many times in my life, and that's one of that absolutely is one of them.
You're about a size 14. The next one you don't even see when he, like, Demi just lets us watch him cut her whole shirt off.
Yes.
And then his curled, crooked, tattooed fucking talons.
Oh, and his nicotine stained fingers, Rob.
Yeah. He goes,
yeah.
Oh, yes. Good. What does he say? Good.
He does this like weird, like, oh.
Good. It's so.
You know what? And I'm going to say this too. Like, I think, like, in a world of movies, like, where we're going to be seeing a lot more movies in time, we're going to, like, this movie shoots the shot for fucking, like, serial killer. You know what I mean? It's just like, it's the one, and everyone else is doing their own thing. But it's like, this is just, it's like, the other ones, I'm like, are okay. Your guys are going a little too far. This one, I'm like, fucking take me to the weird place. Let me go with you. Like, I just want to go on the ride. Like it fully abducts me. And that is, I think, due to timing too, and its release and all of that stuff, but whatever. Yeah. It's just, oh God.
It's a genre movie. Breaker in many ways. That's a little phrase. Yeah. I'm like, it's a genre breaker. It's like, once it comes out, every other movie in this genre must contend with it. You have to just address it. You have to be doing something different. You have to be riffing on some other element of it, or you have to go a 180 and run as far away from it as you possibly can. Or you have to, like, take things to a level of extremity as the show does. Obviously it's the same text, you know, with Hannibal show, but it's doing something so different, but it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible to not have a dialogue with it. You know, even as recently, I'm not sure if you guys saw, did you guys see Long Legs?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, so even, not yet.
Okay. Definitely check it out, Chris. Oz Perkins' new film. It's like, starring Michael Monroe, Nick Cage. Yeah. And like, you've got a woman investigating a serial murderer who's an FBI agent.
With the FBI agent alone.
And you're like, it's like going, we know.
It's, yeah.
It's Oz Perkins is like, we know. Like, guys, we know we're having our little slice of Clarice Starling, but we're going to go somewhere really different. And the movie does. Talk about a very formally fascinating and well-executed movie. But like, yeah, it's this movie just, it gets me on every level. And it's such a also massive reward to go and like, just dig into all the side characters and love them. There's just one other thing. And I swear to God, I love doing this.
It's also such a fucking good movie.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
The first 10 minutes of this movie are better than like fucking interesting. And nothing happens. It's her running in the woods.
Yeah.
Walking through the fucking FBI training facility and having a small interview with Scott Glenn. And it is the most riveting fucking 10 minutes.
Scott Glenn, a too much movie a lot.
Oh, yeah. Like,
two much movies for Scott Glenn. Backdraft and now Silence of the Lambs. Fuck, he had a 90s, baby. He had a 90s.
Backdraft
was 92, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Is that the following year? Yeah. The same year or the following year?
Second year, yeah. Very so close.
So interesting. I would have guessed that Backdraft was like 7 years later because the visual. Like, well, maybe one was this made in the 80s, like 89, maybe, or when did they shoot this one?
No, it was 90. They shot it in 90 because Man Hunter in the early was working on Manhunter in like 85 and it was released in 86.
Backdraft 1991.
Yeah, same year.
Well, and that's your point, like all these different filmmakers are having a conversation with the same text and none of them are really wrong. Ratner, a little bit, he stays in the book a little too much. And
I just want to say this unequivocally. Right. I'm going to repeat this again and again. Ratner has a movie that stars Harvey Keitel, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Anthony Hopkins, Ed Norton, is written by Academy Award-winning screenwriter of The Silence of the Lambs, Ted Talley, adapted from
Ralph Fiennes,
is adapted from Thomas Harris's book, Red Dragon, which I think is actually his best book in the series, even though The Silence of the Lambs is so amazing. And it's shot by Dante Spinotti, the same guy who lensed Heat and Manhunter.
And The Insider.
And it fucking sucks, Rob. It sucks.
But it sucks. It sucks. And like, you can't make Ray Fiennes. You can't make fucking
the Tooth Fairy. I did the worst thing ever. I watched Silence of the Lambs prepping for this pod. And I was like, I was on a high. I finished this movie. I was like, fuck yeah. And I watched Red Dragon. I was like, oh my God. Like Ridley Scott, Jonathan Demme, Michael Mann, Brett Ratner. One of these things is not like the others.
Hannibal, who does the show? It's Fuller, right?
Brian Fuller does Hannibal, yeah.
He makes it his own. He extrapolates in a, such a...
And it has Mads Mikkelsen, who's my favorite working actor. Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen as Hannibal. Yeah, fucking
it's
unbelievable.
Incredible.
It's like
Red Dragon. Yeah, you're
Red Dragon. I can't.
But Michael Mann does something interesting with Red Dragon, which is he doesn't get into Dolarhyde's story at all, other than the necessary turn with, you know, one of my favorite women of all time, Joan Allen, and who's played by Emily Mortimer.
Emily Watson. Yeah.
Emily Watson. But like, we get so much of the Tooth Fairy in Red Dragon. And it's like, I don't fucking care why he does the way he does. Like, I don't fucking care. Anyway, so Michael Mann was just like, no, we're not talking about any of that. Fuck that from the book. Like, this is Will Graham's story.
Yes.
And it's about
just like choice. This is Clarice's story. That's why it's
this
so
is Clarice's story.
Yes. There's two moments before we go into our favorite scenes. There's two things. It's like, as you, I think both of you guys said it, which is that you watch this movie so many times and you find new things. And there's two things that really got me this time. And I'd never noticed them before. And it was only because I've watched the movie like twice in a week. And I so rarely do that with these movies because I'm usually so familiar with it, but this movie fucking rules so hard that I was like, yeah, I'm going to watch it twice in a week. So what?
I watch this movie like six times a year, Blake. It's so good.
No, I totally, but like usually for me, like I give it a little bit of breathing space. I'm like, I need to go back, but it was two times in a week. There's a moment where Anthony Heald is playing Dr. Frederick Chilton, is antagonizing Lecter about, you were tricked by this little fucking, they gave you an island, you're not getting out of here, that scene. And there's a moment where he asks Barney to leave the cell. And Lecter, as Barney is about to leave, Lecter goes, Barney.
I noticed that too.
He's like, don't leave me with this fuck. It's like this, it's the one moment that Lecter actually has a breath. There is one other matching moment, which is so uncharacteristic of Lecter, and it shows how connected Lecter and Clarice are.
Yeah.
There's a moment in the Frederica Bilmel scene where she turns around and she's got the like smelling stuff under her nose so she doesn't smell like the putrid smell of like the decaying body. And she turns around and she looks at Frederica Bilmel and she goes, Bill.
Bill.
She says, Bill. Like she's talking to Buffalo. Like, why would you do this?
I noticed that too.
And that those two things, honestly, maybe the first time I've ever noticed them. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a weird private thought where like an internal thought is external. Like, Barney, stay here because Barney, right. You're a good, decent man. You'll protect me from this guy's torment. And Bill, like trying to have a dialogue, trying to reason with his humanity in this weird thing that there's no way that he can hear or understand or ever, you know, ever have the compassion that she wants to give him because he's a psychopath. But in that moment, she turns around, right. And says, Bill. And I'm just like, this movie for that, because of like how many times you can watch this movie and just miss those things. That's unbelievable. That's unbelievable to me, this movie.
The only, yeah. And he did like, where, yeah, I mean, I don't know why I interrupted. Cause I was like the only time, those are small moments that are clear. And then, but he does cheat. Like Bryan Singer fucking cheats in Usual Suspects, right?
Yeah.
Usual Suspects. Yeah. They show you fucking Kaiser Soze, and then, like, they mislead you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And they intentionally, yeah.
So the crosscut of the Calumet City thing, he gives the title card of location of the house, and then he crosscuts it to the interior of the house in Belvedere, Ohio.
Yes.
And it's a little, it's like, I'll give it to him because it's phenomenal. You know what I mean? And the pop is so big, but it's like a bit of a cheat, right?
Yeah, it's a little cheat. But Jan de Bont, Jan de Bont does the same trick in Speed where he sends Harry to the wrong house.
Right.
It's like, yeah. it's a later trick. People use that same trick. It's so wonderful. All right. Let's take a tiny, tiny break. And then let's come back and talk about our two favorite scenes in the movie.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, Chris, Rob, can you narrow down two favorite scenes in this movie? Can you possibly?
One, there's two moments that I love that aren't exactly scenes. And then the one, every scene is a masterpiece and much is made, but like the scene, the period in Memphis when Hannibal is locked in the cage, is such a departure stylistically.
Yeah.
Because it goes from this drab, the mundane banality of evil into like Hannibal Lecter's fucking
church.
Yeah. Violence opera, you know, with the fucking pictures on the wall and the fucking music and the drawings and the curtain that he's shitting behind, you know what I mean? Like all of it. But that scene is so wonderful. Like, it's such a basic, you know, expectations flip. Like we were just talking about with the interior exterior, like Hannibal uses your expectations against you, which is what he does with Pembry's body. That's Jim Pembry. Talk to him. You know, that guy's fucking amazing. But that scene is so interesting and watchable, and so tense and quiet until they break in that like law enforcement tableau with guns everywhere, you know, just to reveal that angel of death that Hannibal has created to shock them into letting him get away. And that one really stood out to me.
Yeah.
Son of a bitch demanded a second dinner. Lamb chops, extra rare.
And what he wants for breakfast? Damn thing, zoo.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Okay, Doc, grab some flora.
Same drill as before, please.
Mm-hmm. Are you when you are, Sergeant Pembry?
Then this small moment in that Frederica Bimmel scene, which is, by the way, my wife had like a blind dachshund that like at her parents' house, whose name is Freddie. And like for 8 years, I called this dog Frederica Bimmel every time I watched it. And no one understood. It was like a bit for just me and my wife, who's like continued psychosis. But in that audible, I mean, in that autopsy, the dude with the face, like the not Lamar, the other guy,
who the old guy,
like that face. He's got two lines, and that face is such an imprint. And
where he goes, wrongful death.
He's the way he says it.
Yes,
wrongful death. It hit me so much harder this time to watch somebody be confronted with the violence of this dead woman. And that it's not just a killing. It's not just a fucking true crime. You know what I mean? It is a wrong thing that you then watch. She repeats it. And then that wrongfulness weighs heavier and heavier on Clarice as she's forced to like forensically narrate this dead soul, you know?
Okay, Starling.
Bill.
It's
Star-shaped contact entrance wound over the sternum. Muzzle stamp at the top.
Wrongful death.
Wrongful death.
She'll have to go to the state pathologist at Claxton. Well, I better get back to that service. Lamar will help you. Lord Almighty.
And then the other moment, which always makes me laugh, which is akin to the Bill and the Barney, is when Levine, when Jane Gum goes, "You want to use my phone?" And then he starts to like giggle.
Yeah.
Because it's like it's like cats out of the bag. It's like the moment where they both agree that like they know what's happening, and he just starts like laughing. It's so great. Like, "You want to use my phone?" Like,
"Sure, you can use my phone."
"Freeze! Put your hands over your head and turn around. Spread your legs. Spread your legs. Put your hands in the back, thumbs up. Freeze!
Anyway, that's it for me."
Great scenes. Chris?
Yeah, you kind of touched on, like, I definitely think the second jail scene, where was that? It was in Memphis.
Memphis. Yeah, it's like at the courthouse, yeah. Memphis courthouse or something. They've repurposed it or whatever.
Yeah. That scene was super beautiful. There was two scenes that stood out to me. Like, I love that very, like, the intro hallway scene, like I talked about as I was watching it this time. This movie, like, it's funny. That sequence alone reminded me of my guilty pleasure Jurassic Park, where there was actual real fear and violence. And it was like, they're kind of like letting her out into the pen with, like, it was like, it just had this mechanic energy to it that I really appreciate in the attention to detail that is given to these movies.
"Hi, I'm Barney. He told you, don't get near the glass."
"Yes, he did, Clarice Starling."
"Mm-hmm. Nice to meet you, Clarice. You can hang your coat up there if you like."
"Oh, thank you, I will."
"He's past the others. The last cell, you keep to the right. I put out a chair for you."
"Oh, yes, that's very good, thank you."
"I'll be watching. You'll do fine."
"Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?"
"You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?"
"I am, yes."
"May I see your credentials?"
"Certainly."
Where, you know, Clarice is kind of walking down the hallway. Like, I know I've already talked about it, but that scene sets up the movie so well. And the editing, it's really the chunk of the first, you know, half hour of the film, is just so show, not tell. And it is so important when you're watching a movie that it sets up the creepiest vibe in the history of creepy vibes. Like, you just know that there's crazy danger. They're talking about this incredibly dangerous person. And then when he said, the edit that is like the edit of all edits is like, "He's going to kill again." Cut. Tom Petty. American, what is, what's
American, she was
Tom Penn's
an American girl.
that leads then into, we talked about all these scenes already, but they really struck me this time as, because I've been thinking about that a lot, of the concept of showing, not telling. And I was just going like, oh, this movie does it. And it's this interesting balance of like incredible like film training that they teach in film school that I think a lot of film students do when they make a movie, they try and do that. That has gone lost in like current cinema. A lot of telling. We're not really looking at the visual landscape. And I do love this like one little sequence. Barney also does totally come across as like the coolest guy, the nicest guy, the voice of reason in the film. Yeah, he's like, I was always like at ease when he was around. But when like he plants the first clue for her to go find the body in the lock container, and the, like with the mouth and the whole thing, like, and it's just so quick, and he's like, you gotta, like, I just was like, oh fuck, this movie's like fucking launching off, and like I just had
had
a long time. Yeah, it was just like, it was
offense. Go
it's
now.
Just like you just don't like. You just don't buy the urgency when movies do that anymore. You know what I mean? Like, you don't buy those scenes anymore. I mean, maybe you do,
but not a lot of movies have the
time.
Not a lot of movies have the balls to have like a psychopath throw jizz at the main character's face, and then.
But that's why I was saying this movie's so fucking gnarly, and then just like, I was just like, oh fuck, and then this kind of falls into one of my, not my favorite lines in the movie, but. To counter that then with the end of the movie with the reveal of Bill, when Clarice comes on him and they're talking and he's so creepy and like she's kind of questioning him and he's like, oh yeah, was that like a big, she was a big fat lady, right?
Oh,
she's a great big fat person. And then, yeah, like just again, and then that had the cut then too. Oh my god, blanking on kick that, but that, you know, basically kind of did that thing they do in Speed. They're in two places at once. One person's at the wrong place, she's at the very right place, she's in great danger. You know, I was just like, it, you know, the movie is so beautiful in so many ways, which I was talking about with the visual storytelling, but I just those really riled me up. And then of course all the Bill stuff. I mean, we could do a whole conversation about like Bill's torture dungeon, you know, but I feel like that's been done.
Your point about like the cut, like one cut leading to the next, like they pulled that moth out and then it cuts to the Smithsonian right away to like explain this great clue. But instead of like talking to the two weird bug guys giving the answer, right?
Paul Lazar, Dan Butler, they play Dr. Pilcher and Rodan. Cause I always thought his name was Rodent because he goes Rodan. I always thought he called him Rodent, but. Those guys, he's like, do you ever like pizza and beer? Hitting on me?
Are you hitting on me? Yeah.
Yes. I love that guy.
He can't believe he's hitting on a woman. Is this like a real clue? Cool. Well. but it cuts to the museum and her walking among dinosaurs alone and then walking through all these books alone and then apart from these two guys playing this weird beetle chess. And then they start talking about the clue. It's a match cut, but it's still her like navigating these empty and overwhelming spaces, you know, housing possibly nonviolent men, but also like she's alone and easily overpowered by these men who have some fucking weird fucking thing, dude. Like even in the autopsy scene, there's like 11 deputies in there drinking coffee with the fucking body. Like,
and she has to do
doing?
A full. She has to do. So there's two things there. Firstly, that cut from like, someone fed him honey and nightshade. Somebody loved him, and then it cuts to Bill's house, and you're like, what the fuck, Demi? Psycho.
And they cut he cuts the moth. My wife was like, do you notice they're cutting the moth like Frederica got cut? I'm like, or not Frederica, but the woman on Slam. I'm like, that's a good one, honey. You're absolutely right. Like,
perfect. And
killers
then
too.
And then that one, she has to go full West Virginia, which Hannibal teases her about, where she's like, okay, man, thank you so much. So we appreciate it. Go on now. She does the whole go on now and she gets them out.
Yeah.
So great. I'm going to, as you said, I think it's impossible not to say like, fucking lotion of the brush. is not like one of the great scenes of all time. So
yeah,
I'm not
gonna
come.
Yeah, I mean, I'd
fuck me. I mean, come on, like, you know, like everyone's done the, you know, even Clerks 2 does a Jason Mewes does a fantastic Buffalo Bill. It's really great. I want to talk about two things. The cut when she arrives at the Baltimore Psychiatric Institution and you don't see Dr. Frederick Chilton first, you just hear his voice where he goes, oh, he's a monster.
Yeah.
You don't want Hannibal Lecter inside your head. Just do your job, but never forget what he is.
And what is that?
Oh, he's a monster. Pure psychopath. So rare to capture one alive. From a research point of view, Lecter is our most prized asset.
And
yes,
then you get into Anthony Held in full, like, drip lord, sleazoid, shitbag mode. And
did you see the fucking art on his wall? It's like,
oh yeah,
weird
dude.
Portraits of them, like outsider art that looks like he bought, you know, like a fucking New Orleans art fair or something. You know what I mean? Like just weird shit. Just
such weird.
Strange.
Really strange. Fantastic. Number one. 10 out of 10.
10 out of 10.
And I really love the character Ardelia Mapp. It's played by an actor called Cassie Lemons. Is really prominent in the book. She's Clarice's like girl buddy in the FBI around this like extremely male dominated thing. And I just want to shout out to anyone who has ever thought of writing a story or making a film about how powerful you can make a relationship where you can't commit screen time to them connecting or telling backstory or having exposition. But like first scene, Clarice walks in, high five. You know, they're in close proximity at the academy all the time. And then it leads to that fantastic light bulb moment scene with her and Ardelia where they go, what do you covet what you see every day? He knew her. Like that scene, like leading up to that scene and their relationship and all that sort of stuff. It's like, it's such a great payoff and it's done with such a level of like precision and execution the whole way through the movie that by the time you get to it, you're like, who, you don't go, who the fuck is this chick? You're like, oh, it's Clarice's really good buddy. Like you may not even know her name off the top of your head, but you know that Clarice has got a buddy that's at the academy that she works with and that is there. And I just love that. And it's going to eat up into our quotes. So we'll have a quick break in just a second, but I can't wait to talk about Lecter in a full Demi going full Tony Scott, like Top Gun mode, shooting in an airplane hangar with Senator Ruth Martin and some of the lines that he says, Senator Ruth Martin. So let's just take a quick break and we can come back and jump into some of the best fucking quotes ever in any movie in just a moment. All right, I have to.
This movie.
I mean, tell me, Senator, did you nurse Catherine yourself? What? Did you breastfeed her? And she's like, now wait a minute. You hear Paul Krenlicher, now wait a minute. She goes, yes, I did. Toughened your nipples, didn't it? Amputated a man's leg and he can still feel it tickling. Tell me, Mom, when your little girl's on the slab, where will it tickle you? What a fucking line. What a line. 25 out of 10. Take this thing back to Baltimore.
Back to Baltimore.
5'10", strongly built, about 180 pounds, blonde hair, eyes pale blue.
Yeah.
Be about 35 now. So good.
There's, well, I mean, it's a great...
I mean, yeah.
It's such a great
all the lines
juxtaposition of Crawford's point that if you send someone in there with an agenda, he'll toy with you. And if Clarice is a trainee from, you know, one generation away from Paul White Trash, you know, from West Virginia with no status, how he treats her and this fucking
senator,
like that's the two women he faces and he just destroys this senator in her most vulnerable moment. And
destroys it, and then
Clarice a little bit,
and then goes,
"Yeah,
oh, and Senator, yeah, just one more thing. Love your suit,
his eyes. Yeah.
Love your suit."
He has one of my favorite lines is just one word, but it when I heard it again, it chilled me. It's like closer,
closer. I myself can't.
Oh, this is so funny.
I love his hand. Like, it never ceases to amaze me that he looks at the fucking. The deal she offers him, and then the way he fucking like throws it back into the box, and he's like,
oh, yeah.
"Sounds charming," you know, like the disdain in his little wrist movement it's another 25 out of 10.
Oh, Chris, that's so fun. Please find an opportunity for you in some kind of sketch to go closer.
Closer.
Delivery outstanding. But I think that it's, I don't know if it's technically the last line, because I think that you hear Clarice going like, Dr. Lecter, Dr. Lecter, Dr. Lecter. But just like, I'm having an old friend for dinner. It's such a fucking, like, for me, that's like, that's the chilling line of all time to end the movie. I'm having an old friend for dinner. And you're like, oh, Chilton's fucked. Thank God. I want him to eat him. He's a prick. Like, you know, I don't want anyone else to get hurt. I don't want.
There's something so fucked. Like, that end is such a great cap, too, because you watch them go into the distance. It just stays there. But
yeah,
it never ceases to create some kind of emotional confusion for me to see what is obviously a tropical island. Overcast and windy, like a storm is coming, and those expectations always smash together to really off put me. Like, I don't know, it's wonderful.
What's interesting about that, I thought about that too, like the universe of this film, where is it really? You know, like, we're talking about the Northeast and that area, and kind of, you know, but then it takes this turn where it's like in the tropics or where the hell are they?
Yeah, it goes to like, he's in the Caribbean or he's in Haiti or something.
He's got like a Tommy Bahama hat on. Yeah, he's got a Panama hat on. And it's like, it's just got this eeriness to it.
Jim Pembry, goddammit. Sorry, that should be one of their favorite lines.
Yeah.
Talk to him!
It just breaks and location.
And the fucking kid says, "You're looking real good. You're looking good. You're looking real good." And it like cuts to his face, and like nobody has ever looked worse than that fucking guy laying down with his fucking face cut to ribbons. Like, what a fucking piece of shit! Like, who put him in charge? You look good,
but it's rare when you have a movie too where it's like you do have enough, like. If Anthony Hopkins was not in this movie, and I guess this will get to the characters, but like Ted Levine would steal this movie as the creepiest fucking villain of all time. And I was watching this going like, this is kind of like, it's almost like they're like, all right, we're going to do a cop movie, a buddy cop movie, our partner film, but we're taking one of the main cops out and making that person the craziest serial killer of all time. And then we also have to have equally as terrifying of a serial killer to be our main antagonist. Like, it, and I think that's the uneasiness to it, because like he even says it at the very end, like, you know, I can't remember the exact line, but basically to the extent of like, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. And Jodie Foster's like, well, you know, I can't let you just do it. He like says like, I'll give you your safety as long as you let me do whatever I want to do. And she's just like, no, like I have to chase you too. And it's like, so, and I think that's to your point, Rob, of like the uneasiness this film makes. Like, I told Ryan that I was going to watch this, and she's like, why the fuck are you guys watching that movie now? Because it's just like, and then I was thinking from the perspective of a woman too, like, this movie is like fucking like nightmare fuel. And it's all about being hunted and like, who is the good person? Who is the bad person? It really plays with those moral kind of compasses we try to keep. And like, you're leaning on this vicious, vicious, evil person to help you. This is not Star Wars. This is not storybook stuff. This is, hey, you know what? It's like we're talking about cross-dressing and trans culture in this film. It's just got this element of like, what is this? And I don't mean that one is good or bad in that sense.
What's so crazy in this movie is that every time someone's like, is this something to do with the fact that he's trans? They're like, no, that's not the pathology of a trans person. They're like, he's a psychopath. He's a psychopath. He's a violent psychopath.
He's using that.
On point, 30 years ahead of the conversation.
Yeah.
He's just like, his pathology is 1,000 times more savage.
His pathology is it's
nothing to do with that. Yeah.
He doesn't have an identity. And Chris, the funniest line of the whole movie to me is when they tell Clarice that Ardelia says Hannibal Lecter just escaped, and she's like, he won't come after me. And she's like, how can you be sure? And he's like, I can't explain it. He would consider it rude. it's the best fucking. It's, and you're like, yeah, she's right. That's absolutely true. Would. Like, you can feel that. And to your point, like, Ted Levine is so fucking crazy. You would hope that like your daughter gets out of that Uber, but then there's Lecter, if he wasn't in a fucking box, and you know, there's a couple things he says he is probing her with the fellatio and the sex comments, but like he feels safe. He feels like
He can have dinner. He's smart. He's erudite. He's sophisticated. He's disarming. That's what so he
fits in.
He can fit in a very specific upper class, intimidating audience. He can make people feel small. And then when he talks to you and he gets your attention, it's almost like you're fascinated and enthralled by him. But like when he thinks that you're rude, he's like, you know. Dr. Chilton does love his petty torments, you know, like he's just so fucking cool. Like that's what's scary about him. And
I also think I've been thinking about this for another project I've been working on real quick, but like we're talking a lot about generational stuff and like therapy and the generation before us and how there wasn't not the best relationship with therapy. And now guys, you know, our age are like, you know, oh yeah, I go to therapy or whatever, or, that kind of self. And to make the villain the craziest analyst of all time is just fucking like murder fuel for a culture of people who don't want to talk about their feelings already. So it uses the weight of like, I've got all this stuff I don't want to talk about. And the villain is like, oh, I know how to unwind all your little shit. You know, whatever
it's perfect you because know, it's he's like slithering around the miasma of your nightmares, you know?
And exactly.
It's a perfect it's place like, for him to lay in wait, you know, in
and also people saying oh, men would rather do, you know, insert word of whatever than go to therapy. I'm like, we all saw Silence of the Lambs. That's why we don't go to therapy. I just want to be super clear. If you've seen Silence of the Lambs as many times as I have, you don't want an analyst digging around in there and asking you about the screaming of the lambs. Like, no, I'm good. Thank you. Men would rather do a podcast about Silence of the Lambs than go to therapy.
That's true. There is a lot of truth to that. But I guess my point to it is just the timing of it was much more taboo in the 90s and late 80s, I think, for that to be even in the conversation. So it was the perfect job application for a serial killer in Hannibal. And I just think I did want to bring this up too, as we're talking about favorite lines, like, this movie, I could be wrong. I could be very wrong, but it feels like it was edited page to page. Like they handed in, like, you know, a script that was like 9,809 pages long or something like that. And it's just like the editor was like, got it. It's just, that's what I meant at the beginning. It feels very surgical in the sense that it was executed just like a fucking Hannibal Lecter
every shot feels right.
Yeah,
every single, and it just feels
like intentional.
And like a couple of years later, they Clint Eastwood makes Unforgiven, which is another Academy Award winning film, one of my favorite films, a great one. And David Webb Peoples, who is a writer really famous in the 70s, firstly, he's like, Clint didn't touch my script. He didn't change fucking anything. And I get the sense with like Lambs and that, it was like, no, this script is, it's everything it needs. It has all the interpretation of style that a director has and performance, obviously. But it's like, no, it's on the page. We're shooting this movie. This is what's happening. And this is like, that's why I think Ted Talley's a screenplay adaption is like one of the best Oscars given, because it's like it adapts the living shit out of the book. It omits things that don't need to be there. And it just is at a clip. Like it's a 2-hour movie and it flies. It feels like 30 minutes of TV. So there are some TV shows people insist that I watch, and I watch like half an hour and I'm like, have I been watching this for 6 days? Like it's fucking boring. But Silence of the Lambs. Thoughts of the Lambs.
Well, but like, even it always, your eye can always rest. So even like his inserts with that fluttering butterfly mobile at the end when the light comes in, or the fucking bugs, or you know, the blanket and pillow on Jack Crawford's couch that says he sleeps at his office a lot. And by the way, I've read all those books by Douglas, the guy that, you know, he's based on.
Yes.
Mindhunter's based on. Yeah. Like, I read, I think, 9 of his books in a row, and talk about haunting. Like, yeah.
Right.
That, what, it, Glenn is looking at it as an outsider to create patterns and, you know, as data, as a character, but what you know is that like that man looked at so many bodies.
Yeah.
And the real life John Douglas had a full-blown mental fucking brain bleed breakdown in a motel room and it's somewhere like Belvedere, Ohio, on one of these crimes, like a Will Graham brain encephalitis, almost died breakdown. And the toll that is on these people, you know, I'm off point, but
I get what you're, I think
an improv show after you read 9 John Douglas books, because it's like the homicidal triumvirate in every fucking scene. I did the Detroit Improv Festival and we got off stage and it was like the worst show I've ever done, because all I was talking about was like, you know, people pissing their pants into, you know, at 9 years old is a bad sign. I'm like, no jokes, but your eye always has a rich place to land in this movie, which like the TV you're talking about, the telling not showing, most shows aren't taking the time to like put you in the world, build that world that is budgeted to be real. I mean, Silence of the Lambs, even though it's beige and mauve and all these things, it feels like the Midwest.
I'm gonna say this
in the screens, you know, go ahead.
I'm going to just say this real quick. Like, you sometimes watch movies and they feel like their genre. They feel like a movie. This is like a fucking font. It's like it supersedes what a movie, like it. Few movies do this, you know, like in the pantheon of film, few movies just fucking stand out there and they're like, I'm the letter fucking T. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, it's like,
we're a new language. We're a new language. Yeah. Tell like screen stories.
I don't think any of the movies we've seen and talked about on this pod are as fucking erect as Hannibal Lecter standing there. It's a strong fucking movie, man. And I will say we could get into all of it, but it's also this sea of women navigating through a world of men, for sure. Like, I think that that's like the whole other thing to this movie. But yeah. Oh.
Well, I mean, look, I hate to be like a Republican running for Congress, but the movie, I have a daughter and the movie fucking hits a lot different.
Like, yes.
I'm sorry that it does. It shouldn't. I'm embarrassed to say it, you know, but it's obviously the
that shouldn't be part. That shouldn't be partisan though. That's instinctual.
You look at Catherine
that has been
Martin,
weaponized.
You look at Catherine Martin, someone like a Catherine Martin who's kind, and just does an act of kindness to help a guy who has a cast on his arm to put a fucking couch in a car because she's a great big rap person. Yep. She's a size 14, you know, like she's just tough. And she's like, all right, I'll help him put this into the car. Like, it looks like he's really struggling. And the fact that you have to teach a daughter, whether you're a dad or a mom, like, hey, if someone's putting a couch in a car like that and they're, and you get something weird in your gut, go the fuck inside. Don't help.
Run.
Like,
but right. Not just the thing that killed me. I was watching it again last night with my wife. And when she's talking, you know, that again, that flashback of that connection she has with her father. And when I lost my father, I had nothing. I was 10 years old. It made me weep. Mm. And not just the Catherine Martin of it all, which of course, like none of us want to be, understand that type of crime, but the crime of Clarice clawing her way through life, you know, that is that satiric line, getting out, getting anywhere, getting to the FBI,
and
you know,
all the way to the
FBI. Her in a sea of fucking eyeballs and clumsy attempts to date and fuck and manipulate to their own advantage, whether it be Crawford or Lecter, you know, like that's the thing that I was like, how the fuck, what do I'm part of, you know, I mean, like, I hate to be solipsistic here, but I've been part of that problem, you know, and like, it really hit me. And it's fucking 30 years ago,
yeah,
you know,
it's 30
fucking guy.
It's 33 years old.
But Michael Douglas was like, having V-necks and spreading fucking vaginas open, you know what I mean, with fucking Verhoeven, you know, Denny's in there like mapping out how difficult it is to excel, stay safe, be successful, and do good in this world of covetous eyeballs of the male gaze. And how do you protect
She gets hit on in the first like 5 pages, she's hit on. Now, such a tell of where she was about to go into the world of serial killer men. You know,
oh, fucking like Chilton.
It's like,
I've never seen someone so never seen an FBI agent so attractive. He's so gross.
And then when she says, my directions are to return back after, he's like, oh, okay, well, anyway, and like totally fucking dismisses her. It's like, he's such a fucking serpent. He's amazing. Like, he's such a piece of shit. It's so good. Oh, man.
Oh, my God. Well, gents, I don't even think we should even do characters. I think characters, we've spoken about so many of them. James Gunn, bless Ted Levine.
Barney, Team Barney. That's who I am. Team Barney.
Starling, Lecter, James Gum, Chilton,
Ardelia,
Senator
Mapp.
Ruth Martin, Ardelia Mapp,
Ruth Martin,
Jim Pembry. God damn it!
Talk to him.
Dr. Pilcher, Rodin. They're all there, guys. Thank you so much.
Oh, wait. One character we did not talk about.
Okay, go.
During this wicked game that Lecter plays in the Tennessee courthouse is the SWAT team captain, Chris Isaac.
Oh, Chris Isaac, yeah.
I mean, it's just Wicked Game was big at that time.
Which is hilarious because he's the only one who's not a real SWAT commando. And the way he's like holding a gun and stuff as the leader, he doesn't look like a real SWAT guy. But all those other guys are a real SWAT team that they filmed in this movie.
And he gets like top of show credit. Yeah. You know? And he's like, one line is like, all right, let's go. It's like, I bet that song was in the movie and then it got cut when the score came in and they're like, we don't need songs. The score is too good. I interrupted you. Sorry. Go ahead. Take us out again.
That's perfect. Let's go. Guys, thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with another Too Much movie whenever the inspiration strikes. But this one was a special one, and I think it needs to be in the pantheon of ones that we discuss. And as Chris said, it stands erect and alone and bathed in light. amongst the pantheon of these movies. Bless it.
More 20-year too late moral catharsis from Rob Belushi in the next episode.
And
yeah.
And,
yeah,
and hopefully someone as big a drip lord as Anthony Held's Dr. Frederick Chilton.
So good.
This is sending me down the path for sure. Yeah.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.